Now, time for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, a resurgence in the tiger population in India and the traffic goes slow in Prague. But first we go to Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. The city has been attacked 11 times this month by Russia. A wave of missile strikes has disrupted life for the residents there, who've been attempting to live something approaching a normal life after more than 450 days of war. From Kyiv, Emmanuel Shaz reports.
It's a late Friday night in the city centre of Kyiv. The streets are buzzing with life. Terraces are full, music is playing, people are laughing. On occasions like tonight, Kyiv feels like any other European capital. Gorgeous and sophisticated, full of talented, intelligent, fashionable people who just want to have fun on the weekend. It also feels completely surreal, because this atmosphere is only a veil put on so much anxiety and so much pain. This atmosphere also reflects the resilience of a population so very wounded by Russia for so long that people here would take any chance they have to enjoy even just a moment of normalcy in the middle of extraordinary and terrible times. The day was gorgeous. It was sunny, warm, not a cloud in sight. The blooming and huge chestnut and lilac trees everywhere fill the city with a mesmerizing scent. People are eating ice creams, chatting with friends, walking their dogs, eating very tasty food in trendy restaurants. It's hard sometimes to remember that a war is raging hundreds of kilometers away, and sometimes as well right above our heads, if we only look briefly. Yet war is everywhere to be seen. The parking lots are full with pickups from the press, international NGOs, or the army, some just back from the front line and completely covered in mud. Men and women in uniform walk the streets. Others, who have lost an arm or a leg, remind us the gruesome reality of war. And there are the conversations. If one cares to listen, in the subway, on the terraces, in the shops, everybody talks about the war. And of course, there are the sirens, announcing yet another Russian air raid against Ukraine. This month, we in Kyiv were targeted 11 times already by kamikaze drones, ballistic and hypersonic missiles. When they break the sky, those sirens announce the end of normalcy. The other day, I slept so deeply that I missed both the sirens and the very loud alarm on my phone announcing the imminent threat of a missile strike. I woke up startled at around 3 a.m. as the walls and windows were shaking while the sky above Kyiv broke into many explosions, a dozen within a few seconds. It took me a few long seconds to decide what to do. I knew I had no time to go to the shelter, but I also knew that it would not be wise to stay in bed. So, wrapped in my duvet, I hurried to the bathroom in the middle of the flat and sat in the tub. Authorities say that if you can't take shelter in a bunker underground, you should at least make sure two walls separate you from the nearest windows. In case of a missile hit, the second wall will soften the blow and protect you from the shards of an exploded window and hopefully as well from the rubble. But many also say that should a missile hit a building, where you are in the flat wouldn't matter anyway, everything would be pulverized. Anyway, at that moment, sitting in the bathtub and covered with my duvet, there's nothing more I could do. So I did what we usually do here during an attack. I tried to understand whether the explosions were that of air defense or if a missile hit its target. What I hear sounded like air defense. I took my phone with me, so I checked on my friends as well. Maya was awake. She was also sheltering in her bathroom with her dog. Yegor was still away, filming in Donbass. I smiled at the thought that it briefly reassured me before remembering that he was facing even worse. A few minutes later, the explosions had stopped. I ventured into the kitchen. It was light outside already. The sun was slowly rising. I looked out to see two dark trays of smoke in the sky, air defense. I put on the kettle, looking at those trays whose destination was hidden by a building, while hearing the reassuring sound of the water boiling on the counter behind me. I made myself a cup of tea, not sure whether it was worth trying to sleep more before ringing the newsroom. That day, on 2 hours sleep, I reported on those attacks as neutrally as I could, as matter-of-factly as I could, my eyes burning from the lack of sleep and blinded by the beautiful sun over Kyiv, which had become quiet again. Random explosions, tea in the early hours, worrying about my friends in the east. This is my new life. I don't regret it. Kyiv is still beautiful. For World Report in Kyiv, this is Emmanuel Chaz.
Next, we go to India, where a successful project to increase the population of tigers in the country has turned into a dispute between political parties over who should get the credit for the initiative. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited a tiger reserve to announce the success of the breeding project. But his political opponents have their claws out for the Prime Minister, accusing him of attempting to garner headlines for a project that he had little to do with. From India, Sajida Momin reports.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is adept at taking credit for anything that shows him and his Bharatiya Janata Party in a good light. So much so that he now wants to be recognised and feted as the saviour of the ferocious tiger. Seasoned Modi watchers say that any association with the magnificent but dangerous tiger would boost his macho image, which Modi goes to great lengths to cultivate in order to enhance his personal aura at the age of 73. The tiger enjoys a special place in India's psyche, not only because it has been officially designated as India's national animal, but also because the Royal Bengal tiger, with its reddish gold fur and black stripes, has been an enduring symbol of India for as long as anyone can remember. The latest tiger census reveals that India is now home to an estimated 3,167 tigers, accounting for more than 70% of the world's tiger population today. Modi released the new figures, which show that the tiger population in the wild has increased by 200 in the last 4 years, bang in the middle of a rather hectic campaigning for his party ahead of the crucial assembly elections in the southern province of Karnataka, where votes were ultimately cast on May 10th. Taking full credit for the rise in tiger numbers, Modi grandly announced that India had not only saved the tiger, but created a great ecosystem for the big cats to flourish. And Modi himself left no stone unturned to underline his own role in the success story. The day he released the new figures, he promptly undertook a two-hour-long open jeep safari through the Bandipur Tiger Reserve in pole-bound Karnataka. Spread over 912 square kilometres, it is among India's frontline tiger sanctuaries. A picture-perfect Modi sported a cowboy hat, dark glasses and camouflage clothes for the outing. But Modi's and his party's all-out drive to capitalise on the uptick in tiger numbers did not go unnoticed or unchallenged in the combative atmosphere of Karnataka elections and the intense build-up of political rivalry before next year's general elections. The opposition Indian National Congress Party, led by Sonia Gandhi and her son Rahul Gandhi, roared back, accusing Modi of taking undue credit, questioning Modi and accusing him of self-publicity. It insisted that the surge in tiger population is actually the outcome of Project Tiger, a much-acclaimed conservation pushback launched by the then Congress Party Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, way back in 1973, long before Modi captured power in 2014. Importantly, 2023 is the 50th year of Project Tiger. Although Modi called it an important milestone while releasing the new tiger census figures, he gave no credit to Indira Gandhi or the Congress Party for launching the initiative to pull back the Royal Bengal tiger from the brink of extinction. Historically, at the end of the 19th century, there were roughly 40,000 tigers in the jungles of India. But by 1972, their numbers had plunged to 1,411 due to a variety of reasons, especially unchecked sports hunting. Then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was so shocked by the rapid decline in tiger population that she decided to take drastic action. In 1972 itself, she outlawed tiger hunting and introduced the Wildlife Protection Act. The Congress Party tore into Modi for taking undue credit for the success of Project Tiger in its 50th year and milking the increase in tiger population. And in a tweet dripping with sarcasm, the Karnataka unit of the Congress Party appealed to Modi not to sell the Bandipur Tiger Reserve, established way back in 1973, to his good friend Gautam Adani. Adani is India's most powerful billionaire, known for his proximity to Modi. These days, the opposition doesn't miss any opportunity to rake up Modi's close relationship with the tainted billionaire to embarrass the Prime Minister. And Modi's bragging and crowing about the surge in tiger population was simply too irresistible for the Congress Party to pass up. From Calcutta in India, I'm Sujaida Momin.
Finally, we go to the Czech capital, Prague, a city where traffic congestion has been slightly worse than usual in recent weeks due to protests by campaigners demanding a blanket speed limit of 30 kilometres per hour throughout the city. The protests started small but have grown each week and have put the issue front and centre for politicians and the media and led to a necessary but sometimes ill-tempered debate. From Prague, Rob Cameron has more.
The Czech capital, as any tourist website or brochure will tell you, is one of the best preserved medieval cities in Europe. Spared widespread damage during World War II, its cobbled streets, Baroque architecture and famous landmarks, the fairy tale Old Town Square and 14th century Charles Bridge being the most obvious examples, draw millions of tourists each year. But Prague has a problem. Prague has 1.2 million inhabitants and 1.2 million cars. 1.2 million cars that clog up the streets and, often illegally, the pavements, fill the air with exhaust, block the trams and buses with inconsiderate parking and otherwise tussle for right-of-way in an increasingly Mad Max-like struggle for primacy with the brave but determined souls who try and cycle here and the thousands of pedestrians trying to get from A to B. The city sometimes feels like it's choking in traffic. Parking is a nightmare. Czechs are generally passive, affable people and tolerant, but behind the wheel, many become psychopaths. Stepping into this debate is a small but fairly radical group of protesters calling themselves Last Generation, whose activists walk down the capital's congested main roads at the height of rush hour. What they want is a sea change in Prague's urban transport policy, a blanket speed limit of 30 kilometres an hour across the city rather than 50. This, they claim, will reduce death and injuries for cyclists and pedestrians, lower emissions and make the city more livable by encouraging more people to take public transport, cycle or walk. The idea has some supporters, but also many opponents. I took a spin with one of them, the long-term spokesman for former President Václav Klaus, who now runs a political party called Motorists. He agreed there were too many cars in Prague, but what he wants is more space for them, not less, better roads, a completion of the Prague Ring Road, and so on. He's not even against 30 kilometres an hour for residential areas, which does already exist in several districts, but he believes it should be an organic process and not introduced across the city by fiat, as it were. He says the protesters deliberately slowing the traffic are extremists, indulging in actions he had no qualms describing as almost terrorist in nature. And crucially, he says the political parties who want a blanket speed limit of 30, the Greens and leftist Social Democrats, won a tiny number of seats in the elections for the overall city government of Prague. They, in other words, have lost the argument. Well, maybe, But deciding speed limits in residential side streets rather than main thoroughfares is a decision for the city's district councils, like in my own busy neighbourhood of Žižkov in Prague's 3rd district. Prague 3 is run by a coalition which includes the Green Party, and I went for a stroll with an assembly member who specialises in urban planning and transport policy. He supports the protests, even if he admits their radicalism is a shock for the normally sedate Czech local politics. For him, the whole process of tackling the problem was happening too slowly, so who was he to criticise those who want to speed it up? Who indeed? Ultimately, his vision is of a Prague with fewer cars, more bikes, more trees, and total fluidity for the city's excellent public transport. That's the vision. It still feels some way off. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.